incredible. There must be more and more equipment being piled into the aircraft, though.
Yeah.
Did this reduce the bomb load significantly?
Well, now, the equipment that I'm referring to towards the end here was in 100 Group. And 100 Group wasn't even carrying bombs. They were being deceptive. Their job in life was to spoof and to harass.
Yeah.
And generally make life confusing for the enemy and safer for the ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
They were using Stirlings and Halifaxes that had been replaced by by more recent marks and types in the bomber squadrons, but they were quite suitable for this role in this operation.
Mm-hmm.
And they, as I say, they had this one squadron of flying fortresses. Not too many people in the Royal Air Force even knew that there was a squadron of flying fortresses operating. That 100 Group was sort of a hush-hush group.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a great deal. And it came into being towards the end of the war. It came into being in late 43, early 44. And a chap named Addison was the head of it, a very sort of academic-looking Air Vice Marshal. And he was a wizard on these radar devices. And,
bless my soul. Yeah. Bless my soul.
Well, I told you I was going to come back to... let's have a word about efficiency and effectiveness. Through this same period, the Pathfinder group had become more and more skillful.
Mm-hmm.
Their equipments had improved, and they had devised new tactics which were valuable. Mm-hmm. For example, they introduced over and above their marking of the target, they introduced a controller which they called a master bomb aimer, or a master of ceremonies, I guess he was called master of ceremonies, and he and his deputy, or deputies, depending on the size of the raid and the target, he might have one or might have two deputies in case he himself got shot down. There had to be somebody to carry on.
Yeah, yeah.
He would supervise the marking of the target and establish to his own satisfaction that the target was properly marked. It wasn't an aiming point half a mile away or a mile away. If he felt that the target had been incorrectly marked, he would then broadcast instructions accordingly. That the aiming point, he would broadcast the setting that the bomb aimers could set into their bomb sites to take account of this discrepancy. But it wasn't so much that aspect that he was concerned with. But if he felt that the bombs were tending to fall short, it's very easy with a big raid like that. The first fellows come in and aim on those colored markers of the Pathfinders have a good aiming point.
Mm-hmm.
But as dozens and dozens and hundreds of aircraft come and drop their bombs in there, the bombs themselves, with all the fires, they tend to obliterate the markers.
Yeah.
And also, there's always a tendency to lag back. The fellas, you see, they're actually dropping a stick of bombs. You've got so many bombs in there that they generally drop them out in a sequence. So you got a stick coming down. Or, maybe the nose of the stick may be up at the target, and the rest may trail back. Well, later on in the stream, the bomber stream, and when you get so many of these down like that, the fellows coming in behind tend to aim at the fires and the bombs that are exploding down there, and their stick tends to fall back a bit from there, and it tends to drag back. Well, the master of ceremonies was to broadcast to the bomb aimers that they were to compensate for this and aim forward. He might say, you are to aim 100 yards forward of the the conflagration, or so on, and things like that.
And
it wasn't a very enviable assignment to be up there as master bomb maker. Yeah. And these fellows who were skillful at it had to go out and do it time and again. But it meant spending, for example, if you went out over to Berlin, some of those master bomb aimers would circle in those defenses of Berlin amongst the searchlights and the flak for half an hour, giving instructions to the rest of the crew. And at Peenemünde, the same thing. I talked to Fauquier, who was famous air commodore, Fauquier, Canadian. He was the deputy master of ceremonies at Peenemünde. Mm-hmm. And he circled that place for 30 minutes, and the flak of that in that area was fantastic.
The master bombers, pathfinders, they would be higher up than the mainstream coming in, presumably.
Well, they were high and they were forward. And they were ahead of the stream. They were in, and they put their markers down a minute or two or 3 minutes ahead of the bomber stream. And those great big pyrotechnic things they put down there, which produced molten metal in color, were persistent. They lasted for quite a long time.
Yeah.
The master bombmaker might call then, and later, as the raid was developing, as the raid was underway, he might call on some of his reserve pathfinders to put down some more markers if need be. That was another function he had.
Yeah.
And then there was another rather hairy pastime of the pathfinders. And I think Cheshire was involved with this one.
He was He was a VC.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Some of them went out there. Yeah. I find I've got it about 10 more minutes. Some of them would go out on the deck in mosquitoes and mark the target. For example, if the target was going to be thinly cloud-covered,
mm-hmm.
and the cloud was not predicted to be thick enough to obliterate these intensely mm-hmm. colored markers, and they gave off a brilliant light. These chaps would go in on the deck, underneath the cloud, maybe a few hundred feet above the ground at night, and visually identify the target.
Yeah,
and put their markers down on it, and that was a nice pastime at night.
Could they? Would they be so low that they would avoid the radar?
Yeah,
they would.
Yeah, they wouldn't completely avoid it. The radar might know that an aircraft had gone through, but they wouldn't be able to do much about it.
Yeah,
But if there are any. It would be obstacles that would be your worry when you're traveling.
Yes, I can imagine.
Well, just to as a result of all these improvements in pathfinders and improvements in I think improvements in beating the defenses had its effect on improving the bomb accuracy. If you weren't so constantly afraid of that fellow was going to pounce on your tail and shoot you down, I think it tended towards better consistency in the bomb aiming and pressing the attack home. And so, so all in all, there was a marked improvement, and the photographic results showed that the bombs were getting to the target and doing great damage. So. That was a noticeable change when I got back there. But I was going to say a few words about the commanders. Black Mike McEwen had taken over from Brooks in early 1944. Brooks had come to Bomber Command in the late summer of 1942, and he and Stumman formed a small nucleus headquarters and double-banked with four group and learned the techniques and so on, so that they were ready mm-hmm. with their headquarters at Allerton Park, not far from York,
mm-hmm.
On the 1st of January 1943. They had an unenviable task, starting up with a new outfit, a green outfit, and an awful lot of the personnel just fresh over from Canada. And I think they did a very good job, all things considered. Black Mike McEwen came along. He was a much more operational type than Brookie. Mm-hmm. Brookie was a good administrator. He was probably a good man to have in there at the early stages mm-hmm. Of organization. I think he's probably a better organizer than Black Mike. But he wasn't really the operational type. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be said for having the operational type in charge of an operational mm-hmm. outfit.
Yeah.
It has a very, very marked effect on the attitude and the outlook of the crews themselves. Yeah. If a chap could come down and talk their language, come out to the squadrons and rub shoulders a bit with them, and somebody who had a lot of decorations up, and Black Mike had DFC and Bar, I think, and MC and one or two other mm-hmm. operational decorations. Those things, and those were, of course, from World War One. And he was rather the dashing-looking type, where Brookie wasn't.
Yeah.
Brookie was the efficient type.
Yeah.
there was quite a contrast in the two. Now, I find that historians in Ottawa are very prone to ask for comparisons. Mm-hmm. Of six group under these two commanders, and they look at the results and the operational records and so on. They see that an awful lot more perhaps was accomplished during the Hewan regime than during the Brookie regime. Well, it's easy to draw false conclusions from things like that. I think, to be fair to Brooks, you have to recognize that his headquarters was new to the job and relatively inexperienced. All of his staff were, his operational staff, I'm talking about. His station commanders and his Canadian personnel on those stations were comparatively new, fresh over from Canada. His air crew, with a few exceptions, were more or less in the same boat. His ground crew and technicians and the handling of the bombs in mass quantities takes a bit of getting used to. And I remember in January of 43, when we were ordered to bomb up with a certain range of bombs and a certain fuse setting, and then when the day was halfway through and the bombs were halfway installed, counter-instructions coming down say, change the bomb load to such and such and change the fuse settings to such and such. Well, if you're not really expert at this, you don't know all the shortcuts, and that can create a little bit of
a hassle.
and the same thing with the servicing of the aircraft and the servicing of all of those complicated instruments and radar. All those radars are new to our electrical tradesmen from Canada. Well, they were in the learning phase. So that, furthermore, the group was not well equipped. The group was equipped. There's another thing I think that is often overlooked and forgotten. When we set out at the beginning there, we were equipped mainly with Wellingtons. And the Wellingtons, I haven't got anything really against the Wellington. I took them out to North Africa, and they were a first-class aircraft out there, but they were no longer a good aircraft, in the environment over the Ruhr and over the targets in Germany. They just didn't have the performance. Therefore, you couldn't really expect a group equipped with this sort of aircraft to be doing what a group equipped with four-engined modern machines with all the latest aids and devices to navigation and bomb aiming could do.
Yeah.
So I really think that under the circumstances, the headquarters and the group under Brookie did about as much as it could be expected to do in that early phase. Yeah. and they did remarkably well. Certainly, when the time came that Black Mike took over in early 44, it was a different era altogether. We had chaps, we had Canadians who had finished one tour of operations, were starting another. We had commanders of stations who had finished a tour of operations and knew what it was all about.
Yeah.
And we had reached a period where devices had been introduced which minimized the losses for at least for a period of time. All of this had a tremendous effect on morale, and if you get the morale up, you get better, more efficient results.
Yeah.
So that, I think, is a factor you've got to keep in mind. Those are factors you've got to keep in mind when you're talking about the relative effectiveness of the group under these two different commanders.
Yeah.
Now, I think that we'll probably have to wind it up here for the day. I was going to say a little bit about the Tiger Force and the six groups. Intended participation in the Tiger Force, and Black Mike's intended participation in the Tiger Force.
What is Tiger Force?
Tiger Force was the force that was to be sent to the Pacific.
Oh, I see.
And it was organized. The plans for it were made over in the UK in 1944. Late 44 and early 45, we were planning for the moving the force out to the Pacific.
Yeah.
And Six Group was going to play a very major role in that, as far as the Army, British and the Canadian and the Australian and the New Zealand armies were going to participate. But it was going to be fairly largely a British and a Canadian Army effort. And in the air side, we were going to put in a formation almost as big as Six Group. And the RAF were going to put in a mixed formation of RAF, of British, Australian, New Zealand aircraft.
Yeah.
They were all to be long-range machines operating out of one of the islands out there. I just forgot the name of it for some reason, but one of the islands sufficiently close to Japan that these aircraft would have been able to aid with the bombing of Japan.
Yeah.
But Black Mike was the first designated commander of the Tiger Force, Canadian Tiger Force element. Air element.
Oh, yeah.
Bert Hoffmaster was the first designated commander of the Canadian Army element in the Tiger Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I could say a few words about that the next time we come on.
But I wonder if before we did that, Larry, would you want to say anything about those last few months of the war in Europe?
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah. I really think I've got to go.
Yep,
I've got an appointment.
Right.
I'll pick that up the next time.
Okay, good. Good. My golly, it becomes really an electronic warfare, doesn't it?
It does.
Even at that stage.
Now, I gave you an awful lot of detail there, Reg, but I thought it would be interesting
to put
some of that down on paper.
Absolutely. When is...
Do you want to cut this thing off?
Oh, yes. Would you just press the center big button?